Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. I feel fortunate to live at the southern terminus of the Cascade Mountain Range, the iconic volcanic peaks that define the geography of the Pacific Northwest, from here in my Northern California home to British Columbia. They are, as one of our guests will describe, snow cones, conical mountains covered in snow and ice much of the year, from Mount Shasta in California to Mount Hood in Oregon and up through Washington with its towering and massive Mount Rainier. In this program, we'll examine the geologic hazards that these volcanoes represent with three United States Geological Survey scientists from the Cascades Volcano Observatory located in Vancouver, Washington. Ever since the massive eruption of Mount St. Helens in May of 1980, the USGS has been involved in an extensive system of monitoring that keeps track on the pulse of these sleeping giants. And make no mistake, they are merely asleep and will erupt again someday. It is, as is usually the case with geologic hazards, a matter of when rather than if. But with precautions, we can live in the shadows of these beautiful mountains safely, and we'll learn about how the USGS helps to keep tabs on them. Later on in the show, we'll examine one of the most hazardous volcanic phenomena, lahars, or debris flows that can be caused by the sudden melting of ice and snow on these massive mountains. Of special concern is Mount Rainier, which is visible from Seattle and much of Washington State. We'll visit with Alexandra Yetzi, a geophysicist who specializes in monitoring the Cascades volcanoes in general and lahar hazards in particular. We'll also visit with Holly Weiss-Racine, an outreach coordinator for the USGS who helped organize the largest lahar drill ever for communities that live on the flanks of Rainier. But first, let's get an overview of the Cascade volcanoes with John Major. He's the scientist in charge for the Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington, and joins us from there now. John Major, welcome to Blue Dot.
Great. It's great to be here.
I'd like to start with your personal story, your interest in volcanoes. How did you get to where you are now? Give us a nutshell view of how you became interested in volcanoes early on and, you know, to get to where you are now.
Yeah, sure. It's actually been a very nonlinear road. I was actually a recently graduated college student out of the University of Dayton in the spring of 1980. And probably about 2 weeks after I graduated, Mount St. Helens erupted in May of 1980, which back in those days, you know, we didn't have the internet. So probably a day or two after the eruption, I saw little snippet in the newspaper, a story, and probably saw something on the TV news. In the fall of 1980, I had actually had plans to go to graduate school at Penn State University. And it turns out that the professor who was going to be my advisor at Penn State was actually out here working at Mount St. Helens. And so in the summer of 1981, he got me involved in a project out here at Mount St. Helens to work on a master's thesis. And I just kind of ended up staying out here after all of that. And so I've been out here now since summer of 1981. So it's that 41 years ago. And ultimately got a position with the USGS. And so didn't come into the USGS with a direct idea that I'd be working for a volcano observatory for my entire life. I just thought it was, you know, I got involved in a project here early on, and it just kind of blossomed from there.
Well, and I can't think of a better place to be if you were interested in volcanoes than Mount St. Helens.
Oh, it's been a fantastic place to work. It's just an incredible living laboratory out there. And, you know, ever since 1980, I mean, that eruption really changed fundamentally a lot of the knowledge of the field and what we really understand about volcanoes. And it was a real light bulb, real watershed moment, and to kind of get in on the ground floor.
Well, the full name of the Cascades Volcano Observatory is the David A. Johnston Cascades Volcanoes Observatory. Could you know, for those people who don't know, you know, who he was, could you just briefly tell us who David Johnston was?
Yeah, so David Johnston was a geologist with the USGS, the Nation Volcano Hazard Program at the time. He had done a lot of work up in Alaska and was probably one of the few geologists within the USGS who had some experience with explosive volcanoes. a lot of the experience with volcanoes that the USGS had at the time with actual eruptions was over in Hawaii. And that's a very different style of volcanism over there. It's much more placid. It's less explosive, generally, much more fluid lava. So we didn't have a lot of experience. The USGS as a whole didn't have a lot of experience with active explosive volcanism. And David was one of the few people who did. So he was one of the people who was out here trying to anticipate and understand what the volcano might do. He was doing a lot of the monitoring. They had some monitoring sites set up a few ridges away from the volcano, the observation posts. He was one of the people that was manning the observation posts. He had a pretty good idea of how dangerous an explosive volcano could be. So when people would come up, he would tell them, you know, this isn't the safest place to be, you know, depending on what the volcano does. And actually, the evening before the big catastrophic eruption, there were actually a couple people who had come up and were hoping to stay the night with him up on the ridge. And he told them, no, it's probably better if you don't stay up here. You should probably go back to town. And sadly, the following morning, the volcano had its big cataclysmic eruption. And unfortunately, it claimed David's life. So, you know, like I said, he was one of the few people at the time who had any real active experience with explosive volcanism.
Okay, well, let's just give us an overview of the Cascades, because I think everybody's heard of the Cascade Range, but they are volcanic in nature. Could you just give us a little grand tour of hit the major, most important volcanoes, starting from north up in your neck of the woods in Washington and ending down here where I live in Northern California?
Yeah, sure. So there are probably, I guess, going down into California, we're probably pushing about 10 really major volcanoes. So if we start up at the Canadian border, just in northernmost Washington, we have Mount Baker. We start working our way to the south. There's Glacier Peak. One that probably many of your listeners have heard of before is Mount Rainier. It's national park here in Washington state. Then we have Mount St. Helens and Mount Adams. And then we jump down into Oregon, and in northern Oregon, we have Mount Hood. And any of your listeners who may have visited Portland, Oregon, have undoubtedly seen Mount Hood. It's the iconic volcano you can see from Portland. Then we move a little bit further south. We have a volcano called Mount Jefferson. That one has been inactive for quite some time. And then we move down into central Oregon, and there's a cluster of three volcanoes called the Three Sisters. And then a little bit further to the south is Newberry Volcano. And then we get into southern Oregon and we have Crater Lake, again, a national park, probably a place that a number of your listeners may have heard of and even visited. And then when we get into northern California, we have Mount Shasta and then Lassen Peak. So those are the major volcanoes in the range. But in addition to all those major volcanoes, there are other, we call them distributed volcanic fields. They're composed of like cinder cones and lava flows, more the type of volcanism that you see in Hawaii. And that's scattered across the Cascades. So our big snow cones are the real attractors. Those are the really obvious ones. But there's a lot more volcanism and a lot more volcanic features in the Cascade Range other than our really big snow cone volcanoes.
Yeah, it's interesting. Every type of volcano found on Earth is virtually is found in the Cascades, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and in fact, what's kind of interesting, if we just take Mount St. Helens alone, it has erupted everything from the very fluid, runny rivers of lava that people imagine, or the kind of the things that people see in Hawaii. We call that basaltic lava flows. These are very fluid lava flows that can run many, many miles downstream from volcanoes. Mount St. Helens has actually done some of that in its past, to very highly explosive volcanoes and volcanism. And Crater Lake down in southern Oregon is an example of extremely explosive volcanism where the volcano had such a massive explosion that it kind of collapsed in on itself and formed what we call a caldera. So Crater Lake is sort of the inside, the kind of the remnants of the inside of a volcano that's now gradually, you know, eventually filled with a lake. So it's a big circular feature on the landscape with a big lake in it. And used to be a volcano that looked a bit like, you know, Mount St. Helens pre-1980 or Mount Rainier on the landscape today. So we've had just a little bit of everything here in the Cascades.
Well, the type of magma that forms your lava in the volcanic chain of the Cascades determines, you know, how explosive it is. Could you kind of give us a quick explanation of how that works?
Yeah. So there's magma has what we call a silica content. And the lower the silica content, the more runny the lava is. And the higher the silica content, the more viscous the magma and the lava that reaches the surface. So over, for example, let's say over in Hawaii, the silica content of basaltic lava is down, you know, maybe in the low 50%, let's say 51, 52%, somewhere in that range. And so that's not very viscous magma. It's very fluid magma, very, very runny magma. If you get up into the range of maybe 65, 70% silica content in the magma, that magma becomes very, very viscous. And when it's very, very viscous, it's very difficult for the volcanic gases that are in the magma to get out. And when that magma gets close to the surface, because of the viscosity, the gas will explode out of the magma. And so the really viscous magmas are the ones that tend to be very explosive. So kind of in a nutshell, the lower the silica content, the more fluid the lava, the higher the silica content, the more explosive the lava.
Yeah, and silica is like glass. So the glassy right. type lavas like obsidian, those tend to be your explosive types. And it's kind of like pasty stuff that comes out of the ground. It doesn't flow, like you said, like a river of lava you'd see in Hawaii. It comes out like paste. And if you've ever left your cap off your toothpaste and then, you know, it gets all hardened there and you squeeze it up, you got a mess on your hands. That's your explosive volcano.
That's right. So, you know, what'll happen is as that magma gets close to the surface, if it does come out of the vent and it doesn't necessarily explode, it's not going to flow away from the vent. It's going to kind of pile up around the vent and make what we call a lava dome. But more often than not, what happens is when that really viscous magma gets close to the surface, it tends to erupt very explosively.
The terms that we use or have been used over the years to describe volcanoes as far as, you know, will they erupt, an active volcano versus a dormant volcano or an extinct volcano? Do we still use terms like that? Can you explain what those really mean?
Yeah. So generally, if here in the Cascades, if something has erupted over the past 10,000 years, we still consider those volcanoes to be active. They may not have erupted now for a few thousands of years, so they may be in a bit of a dormant state or have a dormant period. But at least over the last 10,000 years, if they had at least one eruption, they're still considered to be an active volcano. As we get much, you know, as we start going back well beyond 10,000 years, 20,000 years, things like that, if they haven't erupted in that long of a time, then they're kind of very deeply dormant. And if they haven't erupted in, you know, many, many tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years, then they're generally considered to be extinct. And the extinct ones are really the truly old ones that are, you know, haven't done anything in over 100,000 years. Most of the Cascade Range volcanoes that we see on the landscape, the big snow cones, they've been very active over maybe the past half million to a million years. They have long histories. Mount St. Helens itself, there's been a volcanic center there for over 300,000 years, even though the volcano that we see on the landscape, most of that grew for the last 4,000 years.
And that's very young.
That's very young. Extremely young. Yeah.
Well, the United States Geological Survey, which you're a part of, monitors all of these volcanoes. Can you tell us like which ones are the ones that are the most heavily monitored that, you know, may be of the biggest concern?
Yeah. So probably about 20 years ago, the USGS did an assessment of all the volcanoes across the United States and its territories. So across the United States and its territories, your listeners may be surprised to know that there are something like 170 active volcanoes that the USGS has to pay attention to. And of those 170 volcanoes, they've been ranked from volcanoes that are considered very high threat volcanoes to those that are considered very low threat. And this ranking is based on some combination of how often the volcano erupts, what it does when it erupts, and what the societal assets are that are potentially at risk if the volcano erupts. So you could have a volcano that erupts very frequently, but it may be way out in the middle of nowhere and there's nothing around it that's at risk. And that would not be a volcano that's considered a very threatening volcano. On the other hand, you might have a volcano that it doesn't erupt all that frequently, but when it does erupt, it erupts very catastrophically. And there are communities located, you know, around the volcano that are at high risk from an eruption. And so here in the Cascades, we have 8 volcanoes that are considered very high threat and 1 volcano that is considered high threat. And so the ones that are considered very high threat are the ones we really need to pay attention to. And so that the top 3 in the nation that are considered very high threat volcanoes, number 1 is Kilauea volcano over in Hawaii. It erupts lava a lot. There are communities that are around the island of Hawaii that are at risk of lava flow. Number 2 in the list is Mount St. Helens, because it erupts pretty frequently. And it, when it does erupt, it's pretty explosive. And there are communities, you know, not right near the volcano, but downstream and downwind of the volcano that are at threat from volcanic products. And then number 3 in our list is Mount Rainier. Now, Mount Rainier has not had a magmatic eruption for 1,000 years. So it's been a while since Mount Rainier last erupted. But Mount Rainier has a history of shedding very large volcanic mud flows that can travel very long distances from the volcano. And there are fairly large communities downriver from the volcano that are potentially at risk from one of these large volcanic mud flows. And so in the Cascades, then the real targets that we are aiming to monitor are these very high threat volcanoes. So we have instrumentation up and down the Cascades on our volcanoes that we are monitoring for earthquakes, we're monitoring for ground deformation, and we do periodic surveys to monitor for gas release.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we let you go, what do you find most rewarding and enjoyable about your work?
I think a couple of things. I mean, number one is it's just fascinating that we live in this landscape and that, you know, that these truly are active volcanoes. I mean, just over the past 4,000 years or so, pretty much every one of the volcanoes in the Cascades has erupted. The other thing I find just utterly fascinating is my particular research interests were in looking at how the landscape responded to the eruption of Mount St. Helens. And just to understand what that volcano was capable of doing, what it did to the landscape, and now how that landscape is responding. And, you know, here we are 44 years after the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980. And as society, we're still dealing with the after effects of that eruption. This volcano deposited an immense amount of sediment across the landscape. There was a big landslide that filled the valley. There was a lot of volcanic ash that got spread across the landscape. And over time, a lot of that material is being eroded and mobilized and moved downstream. And you would think that, okay, after a few years, fine, the landscape will go back and kind of assume sort of the form and the stability that it had prior to the eruption. But, you know, 44 years later, we're still dealing with the aftermath of a cascading suite of events that happened over a span of about 10 minutes.
John Major, the scientist in charge for the Cascades Volcano Observatory there in Washington State, thanks for joining us and explaining to us all about the Cascades. It's been fascinating.
That's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to our guest, John Major, scientist in charge at the Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at the Cascades volcanoes, shifting our attention to the modern technology used in volcanic monitoring for these iconic mountains. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. We now turn our attention to the technology used to monitor the Cascades volcanoes in general and for the threat posed by lahars, debris flows formed by rapidly melting snow and ice in particular. Our guest is Alexandra Yetzi. Alex is a volcano geophysicist at the Cascades Volcano Observatory, and she joins us now. Alex Yetzi, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. First of all, I'd like to know a bit about your journey into the world of volcanology. How did you first become interested in geology in general and volcanoes in particular, and especially the Cascade Range?
Oh, of course. I'm a visual learner. And so when I was in middle school, I remember learning about a lot of things in science class, but not really understanding it. And so one of those was plate tectonics. And that concept is just, it was just so abstract to me at the time. Then one day I was playing with ice sheets on a lake during the winter time with my brother. And I saw how the ice sheets, if you push them in certain ways, they moved past each other, such as like a transform fault. And other sheets would dive underneath the other one, just like a subduction zone. And instantly in my mind, that was the moment where it really clicked to me. What I was learning in class, I could visually see, and it was just like plate tectonics.
Ooh, and you could even push them together and crumple them up so you could make little mini Himalayas.
Yeah. It was super cool. And I won't even talk about the fact that we were standing on those ice sheets. So we might have gotten a little bit wet.
That's great.
But yeah, it was a ton of fun. And I was also from Connecticut. And so I'd never really seen volcanoes before. But I was super fortunate to go to a college where they had this internship program where they would actually fund you to go out and do an internship elsewhere. And so it was really easy to find any place that you wanted to work because it was essentially free labor for them. And so Cascades Volcano Observatory was that for me, junior year of college. So I came out here for an internship and saw Mount St. Helens for the first time. It was my first volcano ever. And I knew from that time on, I had to be a volcanologist. Like, it was just way too cool.
Yeah, if you're going to see your first volcano ever and it's Mount St. Helens, I can't think of anything much better than that.
It was incredible. And especially it was from the north side. So looking straight into the crater from 1980, it was just out of this world.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, your expertise is in lahars and monitoring. So tell us a bit about how you got involved and interested in that. And why don't we start out with, let me back up a bit. Why don't you explain to us, give us your 101 on what lahars are?
Yeah. So lahars are basically this muddy, slurry, kind of concrete-like material that can come off the flanks of the volcanoes. And they can either happen, such as in the Cascades, we have a lot of ice. So when you have an eruption, when lava goes on top of the ice, it melts it a lot. And you get a lot of this water that mixes with that new material that came out of the volcano. And that's what can come down the flanks of the volcano. And that's what happens at Mount St. Helens and Rainier. Smaller or seasonal lahars can also occur at other places, such as just having a lot of tephra on the ground. When you have a lot of rain, it can pick that tephra up and create lahars as well.
And of course, the Pacific Northwest, where you work, is the home of the Cascade Range, and it's all volcanic. It's beautiful, and the reason it is beautiful is because those volcanoes are there. Let's talk a bit about, how the USGS monitors the volcanoes, because a lot of times I'll be talking to somebody about Lassen Peak, where I live, or Mount Shasta, and they'll ask, some pretty basic questions like, well, do they have some kind of way to know what's going on if it was going to erupt? And I tell them, the USGS has these mountains very instrumented. Tell us a bit about that, the state of the art of instrumentation in the Cascade Range up there.
Absolutely. There's a ton of different types of instrumentation that we have. And I like to think that some of the instrumentation has some weaknesses, but that's where you have multidisciplinary observations using a ton of different types of sensors to kind of mitigate those gaps. And so we're really covered on all fronts. We have seismometers that can record things like earthquakes or mass movements such as debris flows. One of my specialties is using these low-frequency microphones to record infrasound or sound waves that are coming from these processes on the Earth. Gas and steam emissions are monitoring using gas instrumentation. Ground deformation is observed using both satellites and land-based sensors. So if a volcano were to start to have unrest, it might start to inflate, and we can record that. We also have infrared satellite remote sensing that can detect heat anomalies. If magma were moving towards the surface, the ground might start to increase in temperature a little bit. We can also look in the optical band from both satellites and webcams for the few times in the Pacific Northwest when it's both daylight and clear. Our webcams are super great for seeing what's happening at the volcano. More towards the Lahar side, we also, in addition to seismic and infrasound, we have tripwires that are essentially these logs that are tied to cables. And so if a large flow were to come down, it would break that cable and it would alarm us that a Lahar of significant volume is coming down the drainage. And then finally, we also have, it's not necessarily instruments, but we have a ton of geologists that are always constantly mapping and analyzing the rock samples to figure out what the volcanoes did in the past, because the past of eruptive activity gives us a glimpse into what we might expect in the future.
Yeah, I always tell people that, you know, one of the differences between earthquakes and volcanoes is volcanoes are kind of like a rattlesnake. They give you some warning. They let you know. It's like, hey, I'm waking up. Be careful here. Whereas earthquakes, you know, if we get a warning, it's only, you know, seconds, maybe a minute, something like that. But volcanoes do, you know, have signals to let you know things are going on. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. And so for the most part, especially in the Cascades, you're absolutely correct. We would expect to have increased numbers of earthquakes. The earthquakes would be moving towards the surface. We would also try to expect to see that inflationary signal as magma was moving towards the surface and the ground was actually swelling. And we would also expect to see different types and higher concentrations of gas that are coming out of the summit prior to something erupting.
Another interesting aspect of this for volcanologists is it can be dangerous work. You know, we have lost volcanologists in the past on Mount St. Helens, you know, the great David Johnston, who was killed up there monitoring Mount St. Helens in May of 1980. I'm curious about what kind of safety training and things that, you know, they teach you to, like, make sure that you stay safe.
Absolutely. There are a ton of different safety measures that we have as volcanologists. And then also working for the federal government, there's even more. And so we do a lot of helicopter work, especially at Mount St. Helens. So there's extensive helicopter training. Every time before we go to a field site, we talk about what hazards we might expect. So if we're in the crater of Mount St. Helens, we might talk about rock falls. If we're doing instrumentation in the debris flow channels or those Lahar channels, we would talk about what we might expect to hear coming down the drainage. Communications is also key. So no matter where we are, we make sure we have multiple lines of communications in case something were to happen, going both directions. So there's a ton of safety training. And then there's also just PPE. So knowing that you have stable hiking boots and plenty of layers to keep you warm or keep the ash away from you.
Yeah, that's definitely important. Well, I'm wondering about, you know, thinking about Mount St. Helens in 1980 and the level of sophistication of the monitoring we had then compared to now. Could you let us know, like, what kind of advances have we made since 1980 with studying, like, the seismicity, the signals you'd see? Would you be able to observe more seismicity now because of, you know, the level of instrumentation and technology you have?
Absolutely. We are in a much better place than we were in 1980. A lot of what we do now, we can do remotely. I can sit on my couch and I could look at the seismic data, or we can look at the GPS measurements. So we don't have to be out in the field physically pulling pieces of tape across to see if the bulge is getting bigger. And so the number and quality and diverse types of instrumentation are constantly improving. And because of that, we can detect different types and more subtle signals that help us monitor the volcano and any changes in that activity. And because of the many different types of observations, we're able to overcome a lot of the weaknesses of one of those instrumentation types by using another. So we can monitor the volcanoes holistically and also with redundancy. So we're not relying on just one type of sensor or one station to observe a certain signal. For Mount St. Helens in particular, we detect a lot more earthquakes and much smaller earthquakes. We can also locate those with higher precision, so we can figure out exactly where they're happening underneath the surface. And that alone helps us improve our ability to monitor the volcano.
And what would be causing those low-level earthquakes? Would that be the movement of magma or other things?
Sometimes there can be... Mount St. Helens is also in a zone where there's a lot of tectonic seismicity. So being able to tease out what's volcanic versus what's regional seismicity is also key. At Mount St. Helens, over the past few years, and especially over the past couple of months, we've seen a slight uptick in the amount of seismicity that's been happening. And this just kind of indicates that there's some sort of pressurization that's happening underneath the volcano. And this is completely normal. We've seen this multiple times over the past 40 years. And it doesn't necessarily mean that an eruption is imminent. It just means that the volcano is going through some phases.
And of course, we mentioned lahars earlier, these giant mud flows that will usually travel down river channels and things like that, but can affect people quite a ways away from the volcano, where they might be safe from the eruptive materials, but the lahar presents a hazard. Could you get into a little more detail on, you know, some of the ways that you can monitor that now?
Yes, absolutely. Lahars are one of the most far-reaching and hazardous events from a volcano. And so this is one of the reasons why we spend so much time focusing on trying to detect lahars happening and try to learn about their characteristics as quickly as we can to help alert the public. So we're constantly testing new types of sensors and new ways to actually process the existing data to illuminate as much information as we can about the volcanoes and especially those lahars high up on the flanks so that we give people enough warning time to act on that. Mount Rainier is one of the bigger lahar producers here in the Pacific Northwest. So infrasound is increasingly being used for both volcano and lahar monitoring and characterization because these sound waves that are low frequency are indicative of something happening on the surface itself. And so it can distinguish between those magma moving just underneath the surface or earthquakes below the surface because it indicates something is happening on the surface. We're also currently testing the use of laser rangefinders as an alternative to those physical tripwires for lahar detection, because the physical tripwires, there might be a second surge in that lahar. And so once it's tripped, it's no longer as useful. And so we're working on using laser rangefinders as well as both seismic and infrasound data for remote monitoring. And increased computation power allows us to process the data in novel ways and with higher resolution than ever before. And so this allows us to use all of these new instrumentations in ways that we've never even been able to do before.
And most of the people that live in the Pacific Northwest in the Cascade Range, from Lassen Peak where I live through Mount Shasta here in Northern California on up into Oregon and Washington, they have a sense that these are volcanoes and that it have erupted in the past and they may erupt someday in the future. But I'm wondering, when you are monitoring all these volcanoes, do they have kind of, you know, a signature of their normal background seismicity? And what would be the signals you'd be looking for to go, okay, we better start paying attention in particular to this mountain?
Yeah, I like to think of volcanoes as kind of being like different family members. All of them have these different temperaments. And that means for each volcano, a different number and type of earthquake is generally considered normal background activity. So we really have to look at each volcano individually, especially in the Cascades. So for example, Mount St. Helens and Rainier tend to have a lot more earthquakes relative to some of the other volcanoes, such as Adams. But basically, we look at the long-term trends. We've had seismometers on many of these volcanoes for decades. We've been looking at the GPS as well for decades. And so we have these really long-term baseline levels of activity. And so it's when we see a notable departure in at least one of those types of monitoring data, and especially the second we see it in at least two of those different types of monitoring data, then we start to get a little bit concerned, and we're able to release some public information statements.
One of the things I find fascinating about volcanoes and geology is it gives you a much different sense of time. You know, our human lives are fairly brief on this planet. But volcanoes, though, are young, geologically speaking. I know a place I can go pick up rocks where I know exactly, you know, when those rocks were born. And they were only born, you know, just over 100 years ago, but that's still beyond my lifetime. So for us human beings and the way we tend to think about time, how concerned should folks be that live near these sleeping giants?
You shouldn't be concerned at all. We carefully monitor each and every one of these volcanoes. Every single day, multiple people are combing through all of the different data streams, and we'll be sure to put information out as soon as we see any type of anomalous activity. I myself look at the monitoring data multiple times a day and have also chosen to live in the Cascades because it is such a beautiful place and eruptions are so infrequent in this area.
Well, Alex Yetzi, a volcano geophysicist at the Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington, thanks for joining us on Blue Dot and sharing your passion for volcanology and monitoring these immense and wonderful volcanoes that make up the Cascade Range.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to our guest, Alexandra Yetzi, geophysicist at the United States Geological Survey's Cascades Volcano Observatory in Washington State. We'll be right back after a short break, but stay with us as we continue our look at the volcanic hazards of the Cascades Range. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our final guest in our special look at the geologic hazards of the Cascades Mountain Range is Holly Weiss-Racine. Holly is a geologist and the outreach coordinator for the United States Geological Survey's Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington, and she joins us now. Holly Weiss-Racine, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hi, thank you so much. Great to be here.
Before we get into the Lahar drill, which is our main focus, I'd like to know about your background and how you got to be where you're at.
Sure. So I have a fairly unique background for the Volcano Science Center. I'm a geologist and I grew up in Maine where we don't have any active volcanoes, but we do have a lot of old granite plutons. I was really inspired to become a geologist by Mount St. Helens. I wasn't born at the time that it erupted, but I did one of those really classic paper mache volcano experiments in about sixth grade, and I was absolutely hooked. So I...
The old vinegar and baking soda?
Yeah. For our sixth grade
science. A little food coloring to make it red?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Classic.
And I lucked out because there was a former professor from the University of Fairbanks who happened to be one of my friend's dads, and I had no idea that he had studied volcanoes. And he came over and looked at my display and said, you know, you can go to school for this. And it was such an aha moment for me. So incredible to have that connection, and it really sunk in. So when I was in school for geology, being in Maine, we were pretty far from any volcanoes, but I ran our GIS lab. And when Mount St. Helens started having its lava dome building eruption in 2004 to 2008, I turned our lab into Mount St. Helens Lava Dome Building Eruption Central.
Oh, cool.
It was really fun. I took three of the computers and I dedicated them, one to the web recorders showing the earthquakes, one to the, at the time, static photos of Mount St. Helens that were taken from the Johnston Ridge Observatory on the Forest Service National Monument, but it only refreshed every 5 minutes and you had to actually click refresh. So every 5 minutes, I would try to walk over and hit refresh all day, every day, so we wouldn't miss any small phreatic explosions. So huge volcano nerd and really wanted to work at Mount St. Helens. And I found out that you could be a park ranger there working with the Forest Service. And so I applied and I moved out there in 2005 to be an interpretive park ranger and had the opportunity over three seasons to talk to hundreds of thousands of people about the volcano and hazards and monitoring science. And it was just such an enlightening opportunity to see how people react, see what they understand, see what really connects with visitors about how to learn about the hazards. And in a not scary way, you want people to understand the risk and the hazards without being afraid. And so that was a really interesting line to walk and practice for 3 years. And while I was a park ranger at Mount St. Helens, I met Carolyn Dreger, who was my predecessor in this position as the outreach coordinator for the Cascades Volcano Observatory. And she worked in that position so tirelessly and selflessly for almost 40 years since the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens. And she just enhanced volcano hazard knowledge and preparedness in the Pacific Northwest. And we're all so lucky to have her. And I realized, you know, that is my dream job, but it's such a great job that people stay in it basically for their entire careers. It had only been Carolyn. So the only opportunity to get that position was to wait for her retirement. And so when she retired in 2003, I applied and was selected and have been in my dream role for about a year.
Well, that's great. I'm just curious before we move on, when you were a ranger, and just, is there one thing that maybe pops to mind? What's one of the major misconceptions that your visitors would have to Mount St. Helens that you would hear a lot and want to, you know, educate them about?
So as a park ranger at Mount St. Helens, we did have a lot of visitors that would come up during the 2004 to 2008 lava dome building eruption and be concerned that it was going to be explosive and dangerous like the 1980 eruption. But those types of eruptions, the effusive lava dome building eruptions like Mount St. Helens was having at that time are not explosive. And that's why we were able to be so close to the volcano up at the observatories and looking straight across at the lava dome building eruption while it was occurring. Eventually, they even opened the volcano to climbing again. You could climb the south side of the mountain and look into the caldera, into the crater of Mount St. Helens. And I think that was the biggest misconception, is that people came up with a lot of fear, thinking that the volcano was going to be capable of a massive explosion and that they were in danger. And so trying to convey to people that there are different types of eruptions that have different causes, and that we know enough to say that at this time, Mount St. Helens isn't primed for a large explosion, and that people were safe at the distance they were at.
Well, let's do a little Lahar 101 before we dive into the drill you were involved with. What exactly is a Lahar, and are there different kinds?
Yeah, so a Lahar is an Indonesian word for volcanic mud flow. And this causes some confusion because whenever there's a big story in the news, a lot of people throw it directly into Google Translate, and it translates to something more like cold lava. And so that's a bit of a misconception. It's actually a volcanic mud flow. So lahars are rapidly moving flows of water, mud, rock, woody debris that originate on volcanoes. And they flow as fluidly as water, but are as dense as wet concrete. They most commonly occur during volcanic eruptions, but can also develop from landslides that occur on the steep slopes of volcanoes in the absence of any eruptive activity. Lahars without an eruption are known locally in the Pacific Northwest as a no-notice lahar. That was a term that was coined by a lot of our emergency management partners as a term that would help the public understand the difference between an eruption-driven lahar and a lahar that occurred without warning from a landslide. In these cases, lahars can occur without warning, which really highlights the importance of anticipating their downstream behavior and hazards.
Well, you were involved with a very large interagency lahar drill around Mount Rainier. Any Cascades volcanoes with snow and ice on them can produce lahars, but what is it about Rainier that is especially concerning?
So Mount Rainier has erupted many times over the past 10,000 years. The largest ash-producing eruption was about 2,200 years ago, and the most recent eruption was about 1,000 years ago. And lahars most often are triggered by eruptions. So if we were going into a period of unrest at Mount Rainier, we would know that the likelihood for a lahar was much higher. The summit of Mount Rainier, so the top of Mount Rainier, has a lot of hydrothermally altered rock, especially on the west side. And that hydrothermally altered rock is basically rock that's been weakened by water and volcanic gases eating away at the rock over time, making it more weak and likely to fall apart. About 500 years ago, there was a collapse of that weakened rock that caused a large lahar at Mount Rainier called the Electron Mud Flow. To our knowledge, this was not connected to an eruption or a large Cascadia quake. The rock just failed, causing a massive landslide. That lahar traveled through the Puyallup River Valley, which is now a really highly populated area. So a future eruption or a large lahar could put thousands of lives and infrastructure in Pierce County at risk. With an eruption-triggered lahar, there would be some advance notice, and we would be able to warn people that the likelihood of a lahar was going up. With a flank collapse scenario, like we saw potentially 500 years ago, the communities would have this no-notice lahar scenario. So there would be no advanced warning. And that's why it's such a concern in the region.
Well, you recently held a very large drill around Mount Rainier. And I'd like you to tell us, like, when was that? And tell us about the scope of that drill and who all was involved.
Yeah, the regional lahar drill at Mount Rainier has actually been going on for a really long time. This year, the drill included 5 school districts, 6 communities, 3 fire and rescue divisions, numerous police divisions, state partners like Washington Emergency Management Division and the State Geological Survey, numerous federal partners like USGS, FEMA, and the National Park Service, and many unique small partners like drone operators, ham radio operators, and the media plays a huge role in the evacuation drill because getting the word out for what this is and why it's important is really important for the community that maybe don't know what's going on or don't have students enrolled in school. So for the number of students involved, it was about 45,000 students. About 15,000 of those evacuated on foot, walking up to 2 miles to safety from their school. And the other approximately 30,000 students did a shelter-in-place drill because their school was located outside of the lahar inundation zone. And so they would shelter in place. But it brings awareness to those students because just because their school is in a safe location, it doesn't mean that they're home or their friend's home or their family's place of work is in a safe location outside of the lahar inundation zone. So it just draws attention to those families to think about and prepare for that kind of an emergency. And the drill has gotten so large that in order to get information to the communities, they created a website that's pretty easy to find. It's called laharexercise.com.
For the people living around Mount Rainier that you've been working with, what kind of notice would they get if there is a lahar imminent? What kind of warning system do you have in place?
At a volcano like Mount Rainier, we have installed a large network of monitoring devices that essentially serve as a warning for when a no-notice lahar would be triggered. And we've partnered with Pierce County and the State of Washington Emergency Management Division to create a warning network because USGS is a monitoring organization. We're not a warning organization. And so we rely on our partners to be able to do and deliver that warning component. And so we've got a network of equipment on the volcano that would let us know when a lahar began. And as the lahar moved down valley, we actually have a network of tsunami style warning sirens that would notify the communities that would be impacted the most rapidly after the lahar was triggered. And so communities like Ording would have about 40 to 50 minutes of notice on a worst case lahar scenario. And the school evacuation drills train to be able to get the students to high ground in that time that they have available. And thankfully, every year when they practice these drills, or every other year as they practice these drills, they have been able to get the students to safety in the time that they have available. one thing about the network is that when the lahar begins, we will know when it begins, but we won't know a lot of the other parameters about the lahar. So we won't know how large it is, and we won't know how fast it's traveling. So there's been a lot of modeling done, and we base the evacuation times and the warnings on sort of the worst case scenario to make sure that people get out of the valley and up to high ground in time.
Well, Holly Weiss-Racine, thanks for sharing your passion and your expertise on the Cascades volcanoes and Mount Rainier in particular and lahars. It was a joy to talk to you. Thanks for joining us on Blue Dot.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to our guests from the United States Geological Survey's Cascades Volcano Observatory, scientist in charge John Major, geophysicist Alexandra Yetzi, and outreach coordinator Holly Weiss-Racine. And a special thanks to USGS Public Affairs Specialist Lucy Alsman for her help in planning this special program and coordinating these interviews. You can learn more about the Cascades Volcano Observatory at usgs.gov/observatories/CVO. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.